part by Cranford Center for the Performing Arts. In the weeks ahead, enjoy free performances in the lobby, traditional music from the Andes Mountains, as presented by Andes Manta of Ecuador, and the jazzy hip-hop sounds of the Cincinnati-based trio Is What. For more information, contact the Cranford Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit CranfordCenter.com. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series. At 4 p.m. on Thursday, November 3rd, in the auditorium of the Beckman Center on the University of Illinois campus, the Illinois Geological Survey is presenting a public lecture titled The Secret Search for Diamonds in North America by award-winning science journalist Kevin Krajcik.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we'll talk about what it's like to search for and find a bird many believed extinct, the ivory-billed woodpecker. Cornell University ornithologist Tim Gallagher and his friend Bobby Harrison sighted the bird in February 2004. It was the first time since 1944 that two qualified observers positively identified the woodpecker in the U.S. Very few recordings of the bird's vocalizations exist. Let's listen to one made in 1935 by Arthur Allen. The recording was captured at close range. A recording of the ivory-billed woodpecker made in 1935. Our guest, Tim Gallagher, is the author of The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-Billed Woodpecker. Tim Gallagher is an award-winning author and wildlife photographer. He is currently the editor-in-chief of Living Bird, published by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Tim Gallagher. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Tim Gallagher, will be in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk this Friday afternoon. And the talk is set for 4 p.m. in the Room D of the College of Law, and the talk is sponsored by the Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences Program and the Environmental Law Society. The book, The Grail Bird, is published by Houghton Mifflin. Again, the phone number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and I'm told that we have a problem somewhere along the line. So let's figure that out, and then we'll get together with Tim Gallagher. Apparently, we had a phone disconnection. So stay tuned, because this will be a good conversation coming up with Tim Gallagher. Thank you. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, and I'm told now that I think we have Tim Gallagher on the line. Tim, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi, how are you?
Great, it's good to be here.
I don't know if you heard my introduction. I don't know what went wrong and when it went wrong, but we played Arthur Allen's recording of the ivory-billed woodpecker made in 1935, and I thought maybe you would like to talk with us a bit about Arthur Allen and the recording we heard.
Yeah, well, that was actually in the real early days of sound recording. And, you know, Peter Paul Kellogg, who was also at Cornell, he was a real pioneer in sound recording. And, you know, this was only about 8 years after this movie, The Jazz Singer, came out. So the system they used was they'd convert the sounds into electrical impulses and then into impulses of light, which was recorded on motion picture film. So it was a pretty primitive system, but, you know, as you heard, it really turned out pretty well.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And we still use those calls if we do playbacks, trying to attract other birds.
Yeah. Now, when Arthur Allen made this recording in 1935, already many people thought the bird was extinct.
Well, in fact, even in about 1920, people thought it was extinct. And Arthur Allen and his wife found a pair of these birds in 1924 in Florida. And, you know, I've read what he wrote about it there. It's like the most exciting thing that ever happened in his life. He'd done that which they thought was impossible. He'd found a pair of ivory-billed woodpeckers. And it made the newspapers all over, you know, that the ivory-billed woodpecker had been rediscovered. Unfortunately, a couple of local taxidermists read about this in the newspaper, and they went out and shot both birds.
Oh.
So then later in the 1930s, when those other birds were found in northeast Louisiana, he was very coy about where he was. I've read some of his letters in the Cornell archives and his telegrams, and he doesn't say exactly where he was when he's seeing the birds.
Yeah. Now, when you and your buddy sighted the bird, and then, you know, basically a year goes by and you're getting ready to make the announcement to the world.
Yeah.
You had your trepidations, too, didn't you, about what to say and how much to say and what you could say?
Well, we were always worried about the place becoming inundated with bird watchers rushing down to see the bird. We really didn't know what would happen. And we wanted to at least have one field season in before we had to deal with that. So, you know, the announcement was made 14 months after our initial sighting, and then there were other follow-up sightings, and of course the videotape that David Leneau made in late April.
Yeah. Now, what since February of 2004, what kinds of recordings, either by video recording or sound recording, have you been able to make?
Well, one of our colleagues, David Leneau, he always left a camcorder running constantly in his canoe wherever he went. And he was lucky enough to have an ivory bill took off a tupelo trunk, and the camcorder happened to be pointing in the perfect direction, and he got about 4 seconds of the bird flying away. And although it wasn't a great video, the bird has all the field marks, the distinctive white going all the way to the rear edge of the wings, and the bird flaps much, and it's larger. We were able to measure the tree it flew off from, so it's larger than affiliated, and it has a flaps per second rate much higher than affiliated.
Mm.
And then also Bobby Harrison, my friend, he made some decoys, and he actually got a short video of a bird flying past the decoy twice. You know, and that's not very good videotape either because there was a lot of foliage. But again, there are a few frames in there that, you know, definitely looks like an ivory bill. So that's about all we've gotten in terms of video. But we also, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology where I work, you know, one of our departments put up autonomous recording units all through the swamp, about 25 of them in two different study areas. And these run for 8 hours a day, 4 hours in the morning and 4 hours in the late afternoon. And they record sounds, but, you know, sound doesn't carry too far, so it really has to be within a couple hundred yards or so. And we did get some recordings that sound strikingly like the so-called Kent calls, which is what you played at the beginning of the program, of an ivory bill, and also some of the display drums, which... It's it's like a double wrap, bam, bam, you know, really close together, only about 80 milliseconds apart. So it's a real distinctive sound these birds use to communicate. And we got, you know, many instances of that, more than 50. So, and they're not just randomly scattered all over the swamp. They're in two distinctive areas, and they're both areas where there have been sightings. So,
yeah.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah. Have bird watchers, have tourists been a problem?
Not so far.
Okay.
But we didn't expect there to be much problem during the summer because it's so hard to get out there. You know, the water level's still really low here. You know, it's hard. You can't get in a canoe in most places anymore. It's just muddy, and they're, you know, all summer there have been cottonmouth water moccasins everywhere, you know? Yeah, which most people don't like to be near them. They're pretty aggressive snakes. And, you know, it's like a jungle, and the birds are known to be fairly silent in the summer, so there wasn't much reason for going out looking for them.
Yeah.
But now we're just getting back into the search. You know, we have people, a team down here that's being trained, and they'll be in full swing by December.
Yeah. Well, what can you tell us about this bird's way of life?
Its way of life?
Yeah.
Well, this is a large bird. It's bigger than a crow, bigger than a pileated, and it really thrived in the old-growth forests, where at any given time there was always a lot of dead and dying trees that were infested with wood-boring beetles and their larvae. I mean, these huge grubs, I mean, they're as big as your thumb. It's one of its favorite foods, and they, with their chisel-like bill, they would peel off bark when it was still really tight and fresh, you know, in a way that other woodpeckers don't usually feed on, you know, when it's that fresh. And they'd strip off these huge pieces of bark and get at these grubs. And, you know, as the old-growth forests were cut down all across the South, of course, their numbers plummeted.
Yeah. Well, what kind of habitat do these birds require?
Well, they really do need a lot of dead and dying trees, and they seem to like remote areas. These birds are pretty reclusive. And, you know, back in the 1940s and 50s, we were at the low point in terms of how bad the forest was, a lot of clear-cut forest all across the South, and it's been growing back ever since. And that's real hopeful to me. A lot of us have always thought, well, if these birds are around, they have to have gotten past that bottleneck in the 50s when things were so bad. But if enough have survived and they're still breeding, then it's real hopeful. So I'm really enthusiastic that we actually saw that bird, which was probably born in the 1990s or maybe even in this century. And so it had parents breeding, you know, 60 years after science had written off this species. And so that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Do they have a long lifespan?
Well, we don't know exactly,
yeah.
But I would say not more than 15, maybe 20 years at the outside.
Yeah.
So it's not like these are holdover birds from the 1940s from those ones that we saw in Louisiana.
Yeah. Well, at this point, can you estimate at all how many birds might be out there?
Well, not really. They're there's probably enough good habitat in this area of Arkansas for you know, 15 or 20 pairs even, but we have no way of knowing if there are that many out there. You know, we're hoping that they're not just here, though, that they're in some of the other areas of the South, because we have gotten reports over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of, they were pretty much ignored for years, but actually the project I started when I was working on my book, The Grail Bird, I wanted to interview a lot of these people, including I started with people who were had seen them in the famous Singer Tract in the 1940s, 30s and 40s, which was that 81,000 acres of primeval forest that was ultimately cut down in the 40s. But, you know, I interviewed a lot of people in their 80s and 90s who remembered the birds from there, but I also found a lot of people who claimed to have seen the bird more recently than that. And some of them were very credible, you know, hunters and fishermen and other people who'd spend a lot of time in, basically out in the swamp, dressed in camouflage, hiding, and they'd see a bird that they didn't, you know, they're good observers, and they saw something they weren't familiar with. So I started following up on those, and usually with Bobby Harrison, we'd go out to these swamps and spend a week or so checking up on sightings. And finally, we had that sighting, Gene Sparling over here in the Cache River Refuge of eastern Arkansas. He had what sounded like a good report. And we'd been checking out another report just 3 weeks earlier from the White River. It was about 48 miles away. And, we looked on a map and thought, well, that's the same drainage. This would be really interesting. It could be a good sighting. And I talked to him only 6 days after he saw the bird, and it was as good as one of these sightings that were 30 or 40 years old, which we've been following up on. So we went down there right away, and on the second day out, we were going to spend a week camping out and floating the length of the bayou, and on the second day we had our sighting.
Yeah. Now, you've said that previous sightings, the sightings and the folks who reported the sightings, it was kind of treated like they'd seen Bigfoot.
Oh, exactly. I mean, people laughed at them. And some of these people who came in, they realized people weren't taking them seriously. They'd tell someone in the game and fish department or something about the bird, and they just think they're idiots. So I tried to enter this with an open mind and take every sighting at its face value and gather the facts. And some of the people, I think most of the people were honest. Some people I could tell after speaking with them for 5 minutes that they just were not good observers, so I didn't take the sighting seriously. But some people clearly were good observers and seemed honest and didn't have anything to gain by, having found this bird. So, I took those more seriously.
Yeah. Why has this bird captivated so many people?
Well, it's a beautiful bird. It's just stunning. It's this deep ebony black bird with white lower back and with these lightning bolts of white going down the back and red on the male's head, and it's longer and more graceful looking and swifter than a pileated woodpecker, which is the one people mistake for it sometimes. And I think beyond that, it's just become a symbol of everything we've lost, and mm-hmm. everything we've done wrong with the environment. And it's so rare that we get another chance. Like, here we had this beautiful, one-of-a-kind bird, like nothing else in America, and we lost it. And now we're finding out that there are probably a few of them around, and it's just such a hopeful thing. I knew it would be a really big thing for bird watchers. This has been the holy grail of birding for 50 or 60 years, but I had no idea that just regular people hearing about this would be so moved. I know on National Public Radio, when they announced it on radio expeditions that first day when we were making the announcement, people all over the country who were commuting to work were having to pull over to the side of the road because they were crying and couldn't see to drive.
Yeah.
And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And people can go back and listen to those reports done by Christopher Joyce
right. At
the National Public Radio website, and they are from April 28th and 29th of 2005.
Right. He actually had come down and spent a lot of time with us in the fall before that, and it was pretty interesting. He interviewed everyone.
Yeah, yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Tim Gallagher, author of The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-billed Woodpecker. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us with questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's back up a little bit. You mentioned Gene Sparling and Bobby Harrison. Tell us about who these two guys are.
Well, being from the North, it's, in some ways I had a visceral fear of the South. I thought, well, I need someone as a Southern dialect coach and interpreter to show me the ropes. And I'd known Bobby for about, 10 or 15 years. We're both wildlife photographers, and so, and actually, I found out that he was interested in ivory bills, too. We had been both interested for years, and it's not the kind of thing you admit to everyone, We just happened to be talking about around the time of the Pearl River searches, and he mentioned having gone down there. I said, oh, you're interested in the ivory bill, too? And so after that, we started going together to all these places. And, he's just a funny guy. He, you know, he was always doing these things like he'd take Dinty Moore boiler packs of stew and boil it in swamp water, and, you know, guy likes to eat, and he'd bring Snickers bars, and he actually kept me fed out in the swamp. You know, I'd always forget to bring stuff to eat.
And he kept you safe from the cottonmouths?
Well, they seemed to like Bobby. You know, they were attracted to him. You know, we even had one time when we wanted to take a picture of this one. We were driving on a dirt road on the top of a levee, and we saw this the biggest cottonmouth I've ever seen. And we said, "Oh, let's stop and get a picture of it." And it suddenly crawled up under his car into the engine compartment. And it was his wife's car, so he was worried about what he was going to tell her. He ended up driving back and forth and slamming on the brakes, and it finally came out. But other times, they were always trying to get in his canoe, and, you know, he'd be pushing him away with a paddle, and they'd keep swimming up to him.
Okay, and now we need to know about Gene.
Yeah, he's sort of a wilderness kayaker. He likes nothing better than to go to a new place he's never been before and spend a couple of weeks floating in a bayou or, you know, going through a swamp or a river drainage. And he was floating down Bayou de Vie in the Cache River Wildlife Refuge, spending about a week doing that. And one of the days, this guy is really good at just sneaking through and not scaring wildlife. He goes in this kayak and he'll slip into a place with a bunch of foliage and just sit there and, you know, watch otters play and beavers and other wildlife. And he was doing this one day, and he saw a huge woodpecker come flying down, you know, from above the canopy and swoop up and land on a tree trunk. And he was just watching it, and it was bigger than any pileated he'd seen, and the color didn't seem right. It had white on its lower back, and, you know, so anyway, when he got home, he wrote a trip report on a canoe club listserv, the Arkansas Canoe Club, and he described his trip, and he happened to mention in you know, about the middle of this thing he wrote up, that he'd seen this woodpecker and you know, how unusual it was and everything. And a bird watcher saw that and told him he should turn in the sighting. Maybe it's an ivory bill. So he sent it to a person I know, Mary Scott, who was a birder out in California who had an ivory bill website and was soliciting reports like that. And she immediately forwarded it to me, and I looked up his phone number and called him. So I interviewed him just 6 days after he saw the bird, and it sounded really, really believable. So, you know, I called up Bobby Harrison, and I said, "Why don't you call this guy and you know, let me know what you think. We'll compare notes." So he called him, and he called me back and said, "Well, I'm going down there. I think he's seen an ivory bill." So I ended up going, too, and it was just amazing. And I think that's the best way, actually. If you hear of a rare bird, you want to get down there as quickly as possible.
Yeah. So it's February 27th, 2004.
Mm-hmm.
How does it happen?
Well, it was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and Bobby was really starving, and he'd misplaced his beef jerky and Snickers bars, and you know, Gene Sparrow said, "Well, I'll go up ahead and look for a dry spot where, you know, you can cook some of your beef stew." And so he was gone, and we were just floating along, and just this bird caught our eye coming up a side slough and just coming toward us and suddenly burst out in front of us. We were in an area of open water, you know, a slough about 80 feet across, and it just came out into the light right in front of us. And you know, in fact, we measured it was 68 feet away, and it swooped up like it was going to land on this tupelo trunk. And, you know, right away when it was flying up, we could see the perfect color pattern of an ivory bill, and it was just a deep black bird with brilliant white on the trailing edge of its wings, and it was swooping up to land, and we just both yelled at the same time, "Ivory bill," of course, spooked the bird,
yeah.
Veered away from the tree and went into the woods. And we just clawed frantically with our paddles, got to the side and jumped out, and we were suddenly knee-deep in mud and just having to scramble over fallen logs and through branches and, you know, tearing at our clothes. And when we finally stopped, Bobby just sat down on a log, and he said, "I saw an ivory bill," and he started sobbing. And I was just wide-eyed in shock. And about that time, Gene Sparling came back. And, you know, he must have thought we got attacked by a bear or something.
Wow.
But, you know, immediately I told Bobby we need to do our field notes now before we talk to each other and influence each other. And so that's, you may have seen those sketches around that were in the New York Times, but we just wrote up our notes right away.
Yeah. So the two of you were certain?
Oh, yes. Just had all the field marks that I knew. This is a breed I had never seen before. Didn't look that much like affiliated at all. I mean, it didn't fly like one. It was much blacker. Everything about it, it was graceful and swift. And I got to see it so well. I mean, I got to confirm the position of the white on the bird's wings and then reconfirm it. And at that point, that's when I yelled ivory bill. I've never been more certain of an identification in my life. I mean, couldn't have been anything else.
Yeah. So who did you tell first?
Well, my wife. I called her up and you know, I think I sounded weird or something. She said, "What, you found an ivory bill or something?" And I just was silent. And I said, "Yes." But then, you know, we spent a few more days trying to find the bird and get a picture, and that didn't happen. And I had to go back to Cornell and tell John Fitzpatrick, the director of the lab of ornithology, that I'd basically seen a Bigfoot. And mm-hmm. I kind of dreaded that. And, you know, when I finally got to work, I got in from the airport about 2:30 in the morning, and I didn't sleep the rest of the night. And I was just like a gray ghost the next morning, hanging around in front of his office. And, you know, I went in and told him the story. And he told me later that I looked so bad that he thought I was going to tell him I had an incurable disease or something. but I told him the story, and he grilled me. He went and got a tape recorder. He had me sitting in a chair when he was pacing back and forth. But he believed me and just launched a search.
Yeah.
In days of that. I was back in the swamp a couple of days after that.
Yeah. Well, you know, even though so much habitat has disappeared, it's still a large area to try to track a rare bird.
Yeah, just in what they call the Big Woods of Arkansas, it's more than 500,000 acres of forested land.
Yeah,
and you know, we checked about 7% of it. And when I say check it, I mean you walk through it and maybe you missed the bird or maybe it flew away. So just because you checked the place doesn't mean the bird wasn't there too. So it is very difficult.
Hmm.
And then you're spending half your time looking out for cottonmouths, you know, instead of looking up too. So you got lots of things to look out for there.
Yeah. Now, okay, once you get John Fitzpatrick, you know, on your side in your camp, was it downhill from there in terms of convincing others that, hey, we've got to get out there and these birds are there?
Well, he basically thought we needed to keep it quiet for a while, so it wasn't like we were looking for mm-hmm. people to tell. It was more like we were letting some people in mm-hmm. to the group, and everyone, of course, who heard about it wanted to be out there searching. So that wasn't a problem. But, you know, it took several weeks before we started having sightings, and then we expanded the search a little, and we had a flurry of sightings, you know, about a mile and a half or two south of where we'd seen the bird. And then David Leno got his video. So, but it's been a long haul. I think most people are pretty accepting now. I mean, you may have heard that some people wrote a rebuttal paper. They didn't believe that we'd proven that bird in the video was an ivory bill woodpecker. And we wrote a response to that paper, and they were both going to be published on an online journal, but we also sent them copies of our acoustic, you know, our recordings that we'd gotten of the double raps and the Kent-like calls. And they withdrew their paper based on that.
Hmm.
So yeah. I think by and large most people are pretty accepting now.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Tim Gallagher is our guest this afternoon. He's at Cornell University. He is the editor-in-chief of Living Bird, which is published by the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. And together with his friend Bobby Harrison, Tim sighted the ivory-billed woodpecker in February 2004, and it was the first time since 1944 that two qualified observers positively identified the woodpecker in the U.S., although as we've been talking this afternoon, it's clear that other people had seen the bird, had sighted the bird, but this was a moment, February 17th, 2004.
27th. When
27th, I'm sorry. Okay, that two qualified observers positively identified the woodpecker. And since then, we have a video and we have recording, sound recordings of raps and calls. Tim Gallagher is the author of The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory Billed Woodpecker. And our guest, Tim Gallagher, will be in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk this week. He'll be in town on Friday afternoon, and the talk is set for 4 p.m. in Room D of the College of Law at the University of Illinois. Tim Gallagher's talk, sponsored by Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences and the Environmental Law Society. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, what does this mean for efforts to preserve, to conserve habitat?
Well, you know, the Nature Conservancy of Arkansas has been really active anyway in wanting to save this area, but this discovery has really put it in everything into high gear. I mean, just since we had that sighting in February 2004, they've brought an additional 20,000 acres of forest into conservation in that area, and they're 10-year goal is 200,000 more acres. And then before, that used to be like a century goal. So this has really speeded things up, and we're very hopeful that this will continue.
Yeah. There have to be other animals, plants, and insects that will benefit, are benefiting, from the interest in the ivory bill and this stepped-up conservation effort.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about saving an entire ecosystem. This is just part of it. You know, and it's nice that we have a flagship species to make that possible, but this is good for everything that's out there, the otters and the solitary warblers and all kinds of other birds.
Yeah. You know, so often we get to this point where we're interested in conservation because there's this magnificent animal, you know, like the ivory-billed woodpecker or whales or what have you, but there's all kinds of other animals, plants, insects in these ecosystems that are also worthy of protection.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. I wanted to ask how old the forest has to be for these birds to survive in it, and what's the potential habitat that it could survive in if it became, the forest got old enough?
Well, you know, they've been surviving in suboptimal habitat, but I think to have a really healthy, sustainable population, you want to have a much older forest. You want 150, 200-year-old trees, and you know, because then at any given time there's plenty of dead and dying trees or dying branches that these wood-boring beetles have infested. And that's what you really need. And you need nest, standing dead timber with big enough to have cavities for their nest and roost holes. So, like I'm saying, right now it's pretty suboptimal habitat in a lot of places, but it's getting better. There's a lot of places where timber hasn't been cut for 50, 60, 70 years, and that's good.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other questions are invited, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. What are the greatest pressures on habitat today?
Oh, well, it's still cutting. I mean, there's still, I think the only reason that there hasn't been more extensive cutting since the 40s and 50s is that, a lot of companies are waiting for the timber to get big enough to harvest again. So, I mean, we could face another wave of major we want to save enough. We want to take enough forested land out of cutting altogether, so that that we have a core area where these birds can survive.
Yeah. Do you expect that as a result of this year's catastrophic hurricanes, that wetland conservation in general will become a higher priority in the U.S.?
Well, it could be, and it's that wasn't necessary. These storms were terrible and wrecked a lot of trees along the coast and everything. Mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily going to end up to be a bad thing for the ivory-billed woodpecker and woodpeckers in general, because these kind of natural disasters, forest fires, hurricanes, tornadoes, and so forth, they a lot of times they end up being good for woodpeckers, and particularly a large one like the ivory-billed, because these trees, in a year or two, the ones that are dead and damaged, they'll be infested by beetles, and they'll be they'll be a major food source.
Well, so much has been written and talked about, though, as the need for wetlands to protect urban areas from, we need the wild areas to protect
urban
areas.
That's right. The whole idea of cutting deep channels and having levees, and during floods now, the water levels are going up higher and higher because they don't have a chance to disperse out through these wetlands. I mean, these wetlands were a great safety valve, and that's gone in a lot of places. The more you channelize things, the worse it is we've seen what happened in New Orleans and places like that. We really need to reestablish some of these places where there are natural hydrology, water flow.
Yeah. Yeah, elsewhere in the country, what pressures do you see on habitat?
Oh, well, there's a lot of development pressure, of course.
Yeah.
People building houses or, farms. Even, we talk about these bottomland forests being cut for logging, but there was also a lot for agriculture. Even in the 70s and 80s, a lot of these places were 60s, 70s, and 80s, a lot of these places were plowed away with bulldozers so they could grow more soybeans when the price of soybeans went sky high. So there are a lot of pressures.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Tim Gallagher, author of The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-billed Woodpecker. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments this afternoon, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. How was it that you first became fascinated by the ivory-billed woodpecker?
Well, I remember reading an article in Life magazine in the 1970s that told about John Dennis, an ornithologist who said he found ivory bills in the Big Thicket country of East Texas. He'd found them in 1966. And that was an interesting story in itself, in that he took the last known pictures of a nesting ivory bill in 1948 in Cuba, so he knew what they looked like and sounded like, and yet when he made those sightings in the Big Thicket of Texas, the ornithological community didn't believe him, and he basically spent his whole life after that trying to prove it and trying to get more conclusive evidence. He was faced with the same kind of things we've been faced with, how the birds being really secretive and hard to photograph. So, I think we've brought him some vindication.
Yeah. Are there other species that are going to be searched for now that people had thought were extinct, but there have been sightings, but it's sort of been the same thing with the ivory-billed woodpecker? It's like, no, that bird's long gone?
Well, there's not the exact situation. I mean, there are a couple other birds that might still be around, like the Bachman's warbler and the Eskimo curlew, which is a large shorebird. But it didn't quite have the same, they didn't reach the level of the ivory bill.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it goes back to the idea of just this magnificent bird. Do you have, in your course of research, have you run across lore about the bird that really that really delighted you?
Well, I did. You know, there are even things that I didn't have time to write in my book. I interviewed a lot of people, and even, you know, one Native American who was sort of a tribal historian and told me a lot of interesting things about how they were viewed by the tribes. There's kind of a warlike image. They admired the tenacity of these birds, and that they could find their prey anywhere. They could, there was no escape from it. They could, you know, bore through the, you know, peel the bark off the tree. They just sensed where these grubs were and everything. And it was something, you know, they had pipes they'd smoke, which were actually war pipes, and that had ivory-billed woodpecker heads. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. As the research continues now on this bird, what kinds of questions are you investigating at the moment?
Well, some of the major things we're working on now are, you know, we're trying to find some birds that their roost holes and nest holes. I mean, that's what we're going to need to be able to study them. I think what we've been seeing is, you know, in BioDeview, I think it was just a corridor. They were, you know, using this. It was a good way to pass through. It was fairly open forest, but they had the canopy of trees to protect them from predators and so forth. And I think we've been seeing it when the birds been en route from one place to another, because there are huge swamp forests that this connects, and this bayou is only, you know, a mile wide or less in places. So we have to find more out about where these birds are and how many there are, and that's our next big step.
Yeah, let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, on line one. Hi.
Hello. How big? How large a population is it needed to be a viable population? Obviously, they managed to get here this far, but I thought their genetic diversity must be pretty low.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say, you know. That's a tough question, because we have seen the whooping crane and the California condor get down to incredibly low numbers, and we haven't necessarily seen any visible genetic problems with them. So it's hard to say. And I personally believe that there are actually more of these birds around than we think, and because I had a whole list of sightings from other states and places that sounded pretty good, which I was going to investigate before I got sidetracked in Arkansas by seeing a bird. But you know, it's a good question, but it's hard to answer. I think we're just going to have to find them and try to, you know, protect these birds and boost their numbers and hope that there aren't any genetic problems.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Anything you want to leave us with, last thoughts here this afternoon?
Well, just that I feel really hopeful about this. You know, it's we've had so many pessimistic things that we've heard all my life, and just to think that the ivory-billed woodpecker is out there is just an amazing thing, and we've got to do what we can to bring it back and bring back its habitat. I mean, I want to see those forests. You know, I can't take my kids somewhere now and show them a primeval forest, southern forest, and, you know, show how it was in Audubon's time. I hope in a couple hundred years my descendants will be able to see something like that with ivory bills in it.
Hmm. Thanks for talking with us this afternoon, Tim.
Well, thank you, Celeste. It was my pleasure.
Tim Gallagher has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. He's the author of The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-billed Woodpecker. And this Friday, November 4th, he'll be in Champaign-Urbana at the University of Illinois to give a talk. The talk set for 4 p.m. in Room D of the College of Law. The talk sponsored by Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences and the Environmental Law Society. And also, he will be the keynote speaker at a fundraising dinner for the Prairie Rivers Network, their annual dinner Friday evening. And for more information on that, let me give you this telephone number, area code 217-344-2371, 344-2371. Tim Gallagher's book, The Grail Bird, published by Houghton Mifflin. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The beans were down anywhere between 1 and 2 cents for the day. Corn was unchanged to off 3/4. The wheat futures finished 4 cents lower in the nearby December contract. They had a high today of 3.17 1/4, the low at 3.13, and a settlement price, or rather the low at 3.12, the settlement price at 3.13, and they finished off a half for the day. The March contract in the wheat pit, a 3.32 1/4 high, low at 3.37 1/4, low to, and a settlement price there at 3.28 1/2. They were down 4 1/4. And the May wheat for the day, a 4 cent drop, 3.40 1/4 the high, the low at 3.36, settlement price at 3.37 1/4. They finished 4 cents lower. July futures, 3.48 the high for the day, the low at 3.43 1/2. July wheat, your harvest month, settled at $3.44 3/4, and they were down 3 1/2 on the day. September futures down 3 cents, 3.56 the high. The low at 51 and a settlement price at $3.52 1/2 a bushel. Once again, that September wheat contract down 3 on the day. From the corn pit, nearby December contract, 196 3/4 the high. New contract low, 195 3/4. Settlement price at 196. They were off 3/4. We'll talk with Paul Cooley this afternoon, see if he thinks that's as far as she'll go or whether there's more downside potential left in the corn market. Cash market, by the way, still rebounding up a half cent today. $1.70 was the Central Illinois cash bid, and that, according to the FarmDoc website, should push at least the technicians and the idea that the cash low is in for the market. That made back on, what, October the 18th, I believe. And then cash prices for soybeans were up a dime, according to that today, at $5.50 from the FarmDoc website. Let's go back to the corn now. March contract in the corn pit, 2.10 1/2 the high, the low at 2.09 3/4. Settlement price at 2.10. They were down 3/4 for the day. May futures, 2.18 3/4 the high, the low at 2.17 3/4. Settlement price at 2.18, down 1 1/4. And July futures, 2.26 the high, the low at 2.25, settled at 2.25 1/4, down 3/4. September corn, 2.33 3/4 the high, the low at 2.33, settlement price at 2.33, even, down 1/2. And December futures, unchanged, 2.43 3/4 the high, the low at 2.42 3/4, settlement price at 2.43 1/4, and they finished unchanged for next year's December corn contract. December soybeans, rather December oats, 162 1/2 the high, the low at 159 1/2, settlement price at 162, 1 1/4 higher for the day. The March oats, 169 1/2 up 1 1/4. Now the soybean complex, of course, no December contract there. Just the November futures leading off, down 1 today, 5.76 the high, low at 5.71, settlement price at 5.73 1/2, and they were off 1 penny. January futures, a 5.87 1/2 high, low at 5.81 1/2, settled at 5.85, down 1 1/2 on the day. March contract in the bean pit, 5.95 1/4 the high, the low at 5.90, settlement price at 5.93. They were down 1 1/4. And the May futures, 6.01 the high, the low at 5.96, settlement price at 5.98 3/4, down 1 1/2. And July futures, 6.06 the high, the low at 6.01, and settlement price at 6.03 3/4, down 1 1/3. August soybeans, 6.05 the high, the low at 6.03, settlement price on that low at $6.03, down 2 3/4. In November soybeans for next year, unchanged, 6.09 1/4, the final price for the day, with a high of a 6.11 1/2 and a low at 6.06. December bean meal, 174.60 the high, the low at 172.10, settled at 173.90. They were down 40 for the day. And the January meal, a 176 high, low at 173.70, settled at 175.50. They were up 80. December bean oil now, 23.01 the high, the low at 22.77, settled at 22.84, down 18. And the January futures had a high of 23.22, a low at 23.01, settlement price at 23.07. They were down 18. One other thing that we'll be updating you on during the closing mark report at this hour in Washington, D.C. The senators are debating part of the 2002 Farm Bill and looking again at lowering the cap. So that will be coming up during the closing market report. If it's important to you, make sure you stay tuned, and we'll give you all the latest updates out of Washington, D.C. That's a look at what's happened at the Chicago Board of Trade and a preview of the mercantile, or preview of what's been happening in Washington, D.C. Now, here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, Todd. It was a higher day today on the Mercantile Exchange. November feeder cattle, the high 115.70, the low 115.05, the settlement 115.52 1/2. That up a nickel. January 114.20, the high 113.40, the low 113.90, the settlement that up 40. March 110.95, the high, the low 110.05, the settlement 110.92 1/2. then up 67 and a half. December live cattle, 90.50 the high, 89.85 the low, 90.30 the settlement, then up 37 and a half. February live cattle, 93.47 and a half the high, 92.92 and a half the low, 93.30 the settlement, then up 25. December lean hog, 62.17 and a half the high, 61.20 the low, the settlement 61.80, that up 95. February, 66 even the high, 65.30 the low, 65.92 and a half the settlement, that up 77 and a half. April lean hog, 66.75 the high, 65.85 the low, the settlement 66.65, that up 102 and a half. May lean hog, 67.87 and a half the high, the low 66.90, the settlement 67.87 and a half, that up 87 and a half. And January bellies, today's high 89.25, that was the high, the low 87.75, the settlement 88.47 and a half, that up 62 and a half. The Dow up 49 points at 10,456, the NASDAQ up 23 at 21.37, the S&P 500 9 higher at 12.11.
Agricultural information on AM 580 is made possible with support from Lincoln Land Agri Energy in Palestine, Illinois. Deferred pricing contracts available this fall. More information at 800-586-2321 or online at lincolnlandagrienergy.com.
It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580, the Information Advantage, WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Our technical director this afternoon, Henry Frain, the producer for the Afternoon Magazine, Harriet Williamson. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon, mostly sunny, highs ranging from 60 in northeastern Indiana to 74 in west central Illinois. Tonight, mainly clear and breezy, lows ranging from 43 in southern Indiana to 50 in west central Illinois. Tomorrow, sunny, windy, and warm, highs ranging from 71 in northern Illinois to near 80 in southwestern Illinois. In Champaign-Urbana this afternoon, sunny and warmer, the high 66, wind southwest.